KSF 90.1 FM Burnaby, independent campus community radio from Simon Fraser University. We broadcast on the unceded ancestral territory of the Coquitlam, Musqueam, Squamish, and the Tsleil-Waututh. We also stream online at cjsf.ca and listen to podcasts of our programs on our website.
The Zionist determination that there would never be a Palestinian state, that they would take all of Palestine at a minimum, they wanted more, and that they would expel the land's non-Jews was explicit and unwavering throughout the three decades from the end of World War I to Israel's self-declaration of statehood and beyond.
That's Thomas Suarez, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamyan. This edition of AR features Thomas Suarez on Zionism, the backstory. The backstory in journalism and scholarship uncovers vital information on important issues that had been obscured or omitted. It provides crucial background. For example, the origin of Zionism is usually traced to a pamphlet Theodor Herzl wrote in 1896 called The Jewish State. However, the contemporary eminent Israeli scholar Ilan Pape writes, "Many people do not know that Zionism began as an evangelical Christian project long before any Jew was thinking about Zionism. Christian Zionists," Pape writes, "were advocating the establishment of a Jewish state in Palestine, knowing very well there were other people living there, Palestinians, but thought that the creation of a Jewish state would not only advance British imperial interests, but also, quote, precipitate the second coming of the Messiah," unquote. Our guest today is Thomas Suarez. He's a London-based historian. A former West Bank resident, he devoted several years to researching poorly tapped and newly declassified historical archives. His books include State of Terror, Writings on the Wall, and Palestine Hijacked. He spoke at the University of Massachusetts in Amherst in mid-April 2024. And now, Thomas Suarez, Zionism, the backstory.
Everything I will say here, I intend as proactive, hands-on tools towards doing whatever we can as individuals, collectively, toward ending the violence for everyone in historic Palestine, making the land river to sea into what it always should have been, a land where everybody, regardless of who you are and regardless of how you got there, plus everybody who, since 1948, has been thrown off the land, can live in peace, equality, and dignity. Now, right off, we face a big problem. We face the problem that, whereas all of us here, I'm absolutely sure, categorically condemn deliberate violence against civilians, that is terrorism, no matter who does it to whom, unfortunately, the United States and the so-called West in general do not agree with us and instead finance and arm terrorism in historic Palestine, block any attempt by the UN to stop it, and muzzle us on its behalf. This is so ingrained in us that we self-censor without even being aware of it. And I consider this to be a big problem, even among us who are fighting this cause. And so we need to reinvigorate our voices, freed from the landmines of what we may say and what we may not say, freed from addressing the issue on their terms. And so I'd like to start right off by stepping on a landmine and addressing the most urgent but taboo subject of October 7th, 2023, because that day offers a microcosm of the past century. There remain endless questions about what happened that day, but what is uncontested is that it was the greatest challenge to Israel from within Palestine since 1948, and that the unison response of the West was of such thunder that the slightest hint of curiosity about what happened and why is silenced as complicity in terrorism. In the UK, where I live, people were arrested and convicted on terrorism charges merely for possessing an image of a hang glider, or for suggesting that the people of Gaza have the right to resist. The enforced script goes like this. It was Israel's 9/11. It was a pogrom, summed up with the constantly repeated catchphrase, October 7th was the deadliest day for Jews since the Holocaust. 76 years of manufacturing our consent is contained in this simple mantra. The problem with it is not statistics. The problem is not that many of the Israelis killed were IDF maintaining the siege of Gaza. The problem is not that many of the civilian victims were killed by the IDF, not by Hamas. And the problem is not even the irony that the reason the victims were Jews is that Israel had ethnically cleansed the region of non-Jews and only allowed Jews to settle it. The problem, rather, is the purpose of this mantra and the purpose of atrocity propaganda spread even by the U.S. president. The deadliest day since the Holocaust is a masterpiece of propaganda because its actual messages, that the Palestinians are the Nazis and deserve to be dealt with as such, and that Israel carries in its bosom the moral authority of the Nazis' victims, are hidden inside the mantra, unsaid, yet screamed at us. We are being fed the imagery of Hamas as motivated by hatred of Jews in order to smear the Palestinians with the same brush to numb us to their genocide. The deadliest day since is a particularly cynical example of how Israel exploits the memory of the Nazis' victims in order to further its own racial nationalist crimes in their name. So let's start by separating October 7th into three parts. One, Hamas's breaching of the barrier within which the people of Gaza are trapped. That is to say, its attempt to liberate the concentration camp that is the Gaza ghetto. We are told that this was an attack. Why? Was the Warsaw Ghetto uprising an attack? Two, Hamas's actions once on the other side of the Israeli wall, which, of course, whatever the truth, must be examined and any crimes condemned. And three, the Israeli state must finally, after 76 years, the Israeli state must finally be held to the same standards to which we hold Hamas. So let's try the experiment. Let's rewind 76 years to see what brought us to October 7th. Gaza is simply a contiguous region of Palestine, a famously beautiful region with a history dating back millennia, until 1948, when Israeli theft of land beyond that to which it had ostensibly agreed in the UN partition severed the region from what became the West Bank. At the same time, the Zionist armies violently uprooted people who lived on land taken by Israel on both sides of partition, but who were not Jewish. And to be clear, not being Jewish was and remains Israel's sole criteria for who it throws off the land or places under apartheid versus those it pays to settle in their place. The common idea of a conflict between Israel and the Palestinians paints a false image, as though this were some real estate dispute for which the Palestinians were eternally dissatisfied. By the end of 1948, many of Israel's victims ended up in Gaza, either pushed there directly or first having been driven into the sea, literally. As Israel cleansed the land of non-Jews, we sat idly by and dubbed the victims refugees, and the hellholes in which they ended up, refugee camps. Now, A refugee camp is a camp for people displaced by war or natural disaster, on account of which are unable to return home. So even during 1948, this terminology was a bit of a stretch. But by early 1949 at the latest, the terms refugee and refugee camp were patently wrong. The displaced Palestinians were perfectly able to go home. They were no longer refugees, if the term ever applied at all. Yet they remained in camps, dying from cold, hunger, and disease. Why? The single reason they remained in camps then, and the sole reason they remain in camps today, is that the Israeli state blocks them from going home because they are not Jewish. End of story. So these are not refugees and refugee camps. They are interned people and internment camps. They are Israeli internment camps for Palestinian non-Jews, paid for by the same international community that now pays for their genocide. The refugee terminology instead makes Israel's blocking people from their own homes sound like some tragedy of history for which no one is to blame and about which nothing can be done. And I am not nitpicking semantics. The world accepts that there are refugees and refugee camps. The world does not accept that there are interned people and internment camps. I'm not suggesting that the refugee terminology was a premeditated conspiracy. I am saying that it conveniently fit the needs of the Israeli state and its Western buddies, whereas accurate language would have caused the public outrage it should have and made the crime untenable. But we need to use this tool now. Challenging the term refugee camps and refugees forces open the topic of who these people are and why they are in camps, which is relevant throughout Palestine and especially at the moment, obviously, in Gaza. The interned Palestinians no more need Israel's permission to go home than any of us here in this room need Israel's permission to go to our homes tonight. And liberating the camps would change everything, river to sea. Israel's determination that non-Jews would not go home was a key reason why it assassinated the UN mediator, Count Bernadotte, in September of 1948. And it was the Israeli state, not the Stern Gang, as is commonly believed, that arranged the murder. Lehi, Stern Gang assassins, pulled the trigger, yes, but they were working for Ben-Gurion. In early 1949, displaced Palestinians did indeed try to go home, both in Gaza and the West Bank. When they did, they were shot dead on site or captured, tortured, and pushed into the desert. Israel called these people trying to go home infiltrators, and we readily accepted this Orwellian newspeak. The siege of Gaza, which we are told began with Hamas rule, was already in effect, as were Israeli atrocities against these very people it kept interned. Israeli aircraft conducted strafing missions over Gaza as well as the West Bank, and massive ground attacks against Gaza came as early as 1953, when future Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon conducted what a UN body described as an appalling case of deliberate mass murder. These continued, and in 1957, Israel killed hundreds of people in Gaza, quote, in cold blood and for no apparent reason, in the words of a UN committee. The story in the West Bank was the same. The population was kept in a constant state of terror, attack, and atrocity. After the 1967 war, Israel formalized its racial Bantustanization of Palestine by issuing all non-Jews ID cards, assigning them to East Jerusalem, the West Bank, or Gaza. Israel treated the three Bantustans as analogous to heaven, purgatory, and hell. Non-Jews could be forced from East Jerusalem to the West Bank or from the West Bank to Gaza, but they could never go the other way. Since 1948, Gaza has always been Israel's torture dungeon. So the decades go by, and the camps overflow in Gaza, in the West Bank, in surrounding countries, and the West's so-called peace process has always been a fraud to buy time for Israel, and such was the case with Oslo. Oslo essentially normalized Israeli crimes back to 1948, but in exchange, the Palestinians were told that they could now have their own pseudo-government, the Palestinian Authority. Now, this was little more than shingles hung on doors in Ramallah. It had no power, and instead served as a fig leaf for Israeli apartheid and as a means to have the international community foot the bill for Israel's occupation. Nor did Oslo do anything to ease the constant state of terror in which Israel kept the Palestinians. For a glimpse of that terror, I'll quote from the eminent journalist Chris Hedges, who was in Gaza in 2002, that is, after Oslo and before Hamas. He wrote that he knows war, he had covered many, but until the IDF in Gaza, he had, quote, never before watched soldiers entice children like mice into a trap and murder them for sport. Come 2006, and the Palestinians are told they could hold elections. Of course, we decided who they could choose from, as the most promising leaders had either been assassinated or imprisoned by Israel. And so the choice really came down to Fatah, which had become viewed as corrupt and collaborators, or Hamas, which at the time had proven itself to respond to the needs of the Palestinian people and to be an opposition to Israel. Yet we feigned shock and outrage when the Palestinians, faced with this choice, opted for Hamas. But Israel did not want Palestinian leaders that did not do its bidding. And so, supported by the U.S., it forced this elected government of all of Palestine into Gaza and kept friendly Fatah in power in the West Bank. Israel's noose around Gaza continually tightened, exerting totalitarian control over your life, down to your caloric intake, who you may love, whether your child may get cancer treatment, whether she may play the violin, and whether she may accept the scholarship she won to a prestigious university abroad. Want to feed your family? Well, Gaza has fertile fishing grounds, but the Israeli Navy will kill you if you venture into the more fertile parts of your own sovereign waters, and the sea closer to shore is contaminated because Israel bombed your waste processing plant and blocks its repair. Or you could farm, but you'll be shot dead by an Israeli sniper or remote control tower if you approach Gaza's most fertile grounds furthest from the shore. Israel's carnage against Gaza in the summer of 2014 alone had roughly the same human toll as the 9/11 terror attacks. This is in actual numbers, not adjusted for population. And the excuse for it was every bit as obscene. The U.S. Congress applauded it, and why shouldn't they? After all, it was their massacre as much as Israel's. Israel's guarantee of execution for any attempt by a non-Jew to return home has only tightened since 1948. In the so-called Great March of Return of 2018 to 19, hundreds of people were shot dead or permanently and deliberately crippled by Israeli snipers for a merely symbolic show of just approaching the impenetrable barrier of the Gaza ghetto. To be clear, this did not even rise to the level of civil disobedience. They were confined in the concentration camp in which we've locked them and were murdered merely for symbolism of their most rudimentary human rights. There could be no better proof of the fact of and the futility of Palestinian peaceful resistance, which, by the way, goes back decades and into the pre-state period. Meanwhile, Israel continued to ethnically cleanse people from both East Jerusalem and the West Bank. Thousands of non-Jews in the West Bank continued to be kidnapped and taken hostage by Israel, and hundreds murdered. But Hamas, The government elected to defend them was holed up in Gaza and denied any conventional means of defense, whether military or political. The only thing it could do was lob primitive rockets over the barrier in protest, most hitting the land on the immediate other side, which is actually, ironically, the home of many of the people interned in Gaza. Yet when 75 years of this pressure cooker inferno blew up on the morning of October 7th, we said with a straight face and an irony that will baffle future historians that there's no excuse for terrorism. One crime we know for sure that Hamas committed that day was the taking of hostages. After 75 years of Israel kidnapping Palestinians, currently holding 10 to 11,000 hostages, Hamas kidnaps a couple of hundred as leverage, and suddenly we learn that nothing can justify it. The question of why our governments will destroy us personally, professionally, collectively, morally, to empower Israel's crimes is a mystery to which I don't have a satisfactory answer, but I don't think we should get sidetracked by it, because our governments are amoral organisms that plow ahead in their own interests. It's not for a lack of understanding or for a lack of information that the Biden administration is conducting genocide. But our governments do require our tacit complicity. So the question becomes, how has the public been kept ignorant of what is being done in their name? Typically, we have fought against the bubble in which we live by exposing Israel's crimes. And this is obviously important. But 76 years of exposing Israel's crimes has not stopped them. It has not stopped them because even when news of Israel's crimes reaches us, we filter it through quote-unquote narrative, that is, sophisticated marketing. Israel has above all been a marketing project. As the USA branch of the Irgun, the terror gang, the Irgun, back in the 1940s described it, they fundraised, their quote, just the way you would advertise Chevrolet motor cars or Players cigarettes. So we need to go beyond Israel's crimes and expose its structures of impunity. How to get us addicted to a product that makes a mockery of every value we claim to hold dear? Well, you would start with an unassailable brand name, Israel, a name that touches a chord deep within our collective cultural subconscious, a word originating in Genesis itself, a place seemingly created by God, a word celebrated in Negro spirituals and praised in church. In short, a name that even the secular among us are culturally wired to honor. And Israel, the modern nation state, openly positions itself as that place, the land's ancient artifacts as the nation state's artifacts, and its settlers as the biblical land's people. Zionism is grand messianic theater. As Ben-Gurion explained cynically in private, without the name Israel, they'd never get enough settlers. Nor would they recruit participants in the theater without Palestine itself, the all-important stage on which this great messianic theater plays out. Now, it's sometimes mentioned that Herzl considered other locations, but he was explicit that these were only meant as stepping stones to Palestine if Palestine could not be gotten at first. So they marketed their state as the reconstitution of the biblical realm in Palestine, reversing the standard settler colonial narrative. Instead of commandeering other people's lands through claims of divine right or manifest destiny, the Zionist narrative was the opposite. They were not settlers, but were simply going home after a hiatus of 2,000 or 3,000 years. Thus, the Zionist project is a step beyond even those of colonial Europe, because the Zionist claim of indigenousness requires that it replace the native people, not just physically, but also metaphysically, erasing them by expropriating their cultural iconography as its own in order to become the native. It is genocide in its fullest sense. As if, for example, as if Spanish colonizers in South and Central America were to have claimed that all Mayan and Incan and Aztec artifacts and culture and food and music, etc., were actually those of ancient Spaniards, and that the people found there were interlopers with no right to the land. And finally, the project needed a slogan. For its slogan, it trademarked the Jewish state. But what does this slogan mean? We accept this trilogy of words, the Jewish state, with little thought. After all, as Israel's defenders tell us, there are Christian states and Buddhist states and Hindu states and Muslim states. And Israel is the only Jewish state, with the insinuation that if you're against it, that must be why. No, this is false advertising. Israel is the only Jewish state, not in the sense that there happen to be no others, but because by Israel's construct, there can be no others. The key word here is the article. The. Israel claims to be the, not a, Jewish state. Its claim over Jews is global and involves ethnicity, DNA, not citizenship. If you're Jewish, it claims to own you. The very sound of the term the Jewish state demands unqualified respect and creates a magic shield, a force field around Israel, warning us not to challenge the state. It shoots its bullets without leaving any forensic evidence, like a talisman that wards off enemies without leaving any trace. For example, I'm sure many of us here have heard the following rebuttal. Why are you always criticizing the Jewish state? But what Israel really means by its slogan is an affront and deserves condemnation. What Israel means by it is the perversion of Jewish identity into racial nationalism. It means that the state must enforce a Jewish majority river to sea, which it defines by blood descent and preserves this alleged blood purity by way of laws forbidding so-called mixed marriages between a Jew and a non-Jew as defined by the state. All others on the land must remain both a minority and legally lesser human beings. Thus, the Israeli state, by its own self-definition, a definition we have embraced, has no choice but to keep millions of human beings in internment camps, no choice but to maintain apartheid river to sea, no choice but to kill people for the crime of going home while not Jewish, and ultimately to conduct genocide. As long as we endorse the existence of a state based on blood descent supremacy of an imported population, we have endorsed these crimes. If the people of the land simply went home, if people were simply equal under the law, the state would cease to exist, and that is therefore what must happen. No nation state has an intrinsic right to exist. A nation state is a 19th century invention. People, everyone there now, by which, okay, let's include all the settlers, but above all, everyone who has been ethnically cleansed, they have the intrinsic right to exist as equals on that land, river to sea. But Israel has this magic shield around it that other former race states, such as apartheid South Africa, did not. If we put the Israeli state on the allegorical lab table, unscrew the cover, and look inside to see what powers this magic shield, we'll find that its energy source is a hostage. That hostage being Jewish identity, the Israeli state's claim to be the very embodiment of everything and everyone Jewish. Deny Israel this anti-Semitic hijacking of Jewish identity as a human shield, and its seemingly impenetrable armor vaporizes. And that is the key, in my view, to our project.
You're listening to Thomas Suarez on Zionism, The Backstory. This is Independent Alternative Radio. For copies of this program, call us 1-800-444-1999.